It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. And Bruce Devlin, our guest today is our first repeater.
That's
and
right.
I think he won something.
Well, he's a former, well, actually not a former, but a British Open champion, or what we would call today the Open champion, Ian Baker Finch. Glad to have you with us. What a career you've had, not only on the golf course, but television and Olympics and President's Cup. And, you know, we got a lot to talk about. Welcome, buddy.
Thanks very much, Bruce. Great to be with you. And Mike, thanks for doing this again. Really enjoyed the last one. And I've really enjoyed listening to all of the episodes I've had a chance to listen to so far. You're doing a great job.
Well, thanks and welcome back. Great to have you. And you've been quite busy since we last were with you.
Yes. Yeah. I went over to Tokyo for the Olympics, and that was absolutely fantastic. I had had a great time. And Bruce, you can imagine this. I had a dose of Australiana.
Yeah, I bet.
That I really needed.
Yeah, I bet you did. And I tell you what, you had a pretty good team too.
Yeah, Mark Leishman and Cam Smith for the men in the first week.
Yeah.
And then the second week was Hannah Green and Minji Lee. And everyone had a great time and performed well and represented Australia in the green and gold the way you'd want them to.
Yeah.
Well, terrific. We're looking forward to hearing more about your Olympic experience. I'm sure that was quite special. You know, last time we sort of left off with just talking about major championships, and we talked a lot about the Masters in terms of coverage, your CBS experience and so forth, and that was quite interesting. The thing we failed to cover was the big one, obviously, which was your Open Championship win in 1991. So, but before we jump into that, I know you related your experience on your first Open Championship, which was quite special, playing with the guys you did that led you around the course. That, of course, was quite useful to prepare you for your later Open Championships. But that was back in 1984. That was the famous Seve fist pump win at the old course, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was an amazing week for me, my first Open Championship, and had a chance to win, was leading after the second and third rounds. Got to play with Tom Watson in the final round. And Tom and I were in that last group on the 18th tee when Seve holed the putt to win. After Tom had made a bit of a mess of the 17th hole there, the road hole. So that was a great experience for me. I finished ninth, unfortunately, had a bad last day, but the experience as a 23-year-old just gave me that love of the Open. Bruce understands that. It's something that we Australians aspire to play in, let alone have a chance to win.
Absolutely.
And to do it at St Andrews was extra special. So that was the start of my dream, actually. It was a great week. We've touched on that, and it gave me the belief in myself that I could one day win it. So that was the start of the journey.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tom Watson had his other chances. since we visited with you, we had a chance to talk to him about his five Open Championship wins. Of course, it was during Open Week that we talked to Tom, and of course, he remembers this Open as well. I think we talked about it. The other thing we talked about was we had Nick Price yesterday. And he told a little story about how he was slumming it around Europe for a couple of months. And it reminded me of the story you told of bunking up with Mike Clayton and the boys, sharing a room and, you know, really roughing it.
Yeah. Well, you had to save money in those days. No one was making any money. I think the year before I made like, I don't know, $10,000 or whatever for the year until I finally had a win and a couple of good finishes. But if you made $50,000 in a year, you were playing pretty well back then around the world, in Europe, et cetera. And the Open was your big chance to make a good check, because it was obviously the largest event, being a major championship. But you just stayed with your mates, three or four in a room. At that Open, we had six of us in a house, one bathroom. My girlfriend at the time, Jenny, now my wife, was with us, with Clayton and Grady and Stevie Williams and our manager. We were all there slumming it in this old farmhouse. But that's how you did it.
Yeah.
And it was fun.
Yeah. Curtis Strange said that he and Sarah used to budget about $18 a night for hotels.
Yeah, you can't get breakfast for that now.
Well, let's jump ahead to 1990, which was also a good preparation. Again, at the old course, you shoot 64 on Saturday to put yourself in the final pairing with the eventual winner, Nick Faldo.
Yeah, the Saturday was a great round for me, memorable. I was 9 under par through 12 holes and thought, you know, if everything kept going swimmingly, I'd be a chance of shooting something extra special, maybe breaking that 63 barrier that was the championship record and major championship record. And I missed a couple of putts that I could have made, and I three-putted 17 and didn't make a birdie at the last, so ended up with 8 under 64. But that got me into that last group again. So after being in the last group in 84, I was in the last group again with Nick Faldo this time. And Nick was just put on an exhibition and won in style, and I think a record score from memory at that time. And a quick memory there, Nick was, he gets so caught up in his own game, and that's why he was so great, Bruce, as you can imagine and understand in majors. He didn't really even realize I was there. He was just in a trance. It wasn't nasty in any way. I'm not saying that, but it was just he was doing his job. And he hit his first putt on 18 up close, and he was walking up to tap it in. And I said, Nick, Nick, Nick. And he sort of stopped and turned around. I said, hey, would you mind marking
letting me
putt?
Let me finish, will you?
Yeah, I mean, it's only 6 inches, buddy. It's not like you're going to miss it six times to lose. I think he was winning by 3 or 4 shots. But anyway, that day with Nick really gave me a great lesson in how you had to be if you were going to eventually win one of these major championships. I knew I had the ability if I played my best, but he showed me how you do it, and it's why I went on the next year. I really focused a lot better the next time I had a chance.
And interestingly, that subject came up again with Nick Price about how important it was to watch a guy like Nicklaus, who would, you know, talk with you for a while as you walk along the fairway, but when he got 15 yards from his ball, he went into his little zone too. You know, mm-hmm. you could have let off a firecracker and it wouldn't have affected him.
Yeah, he was the best, wasn't he?
I think so.
Yeah, and then Tiger maybe took it to another level.
Let's go to Birkdale, 1991. Just what, you know, frame of mind and so forth going into that week.
I was in a great frame of mind. I was in a very, very good place in my life. We just had a little baby girl that was, we were enjoying. Jenny was pregnant with our second girl, Laura, at the time, about 5 months or so. Traveled over after losing in a playoff to Bruce Fleischer the week before at the Pleasant Valley event. Had a chance to win there, should have won, lost in the playoff. Anyway, chose the right one to win, I guess.
Yeah.
And went in there with, as really a lot of the players and caddies backed me that week. It was one of the worst results for the bookies. They had me at about 40 to 1 coming in there, and I'd been playing well every week in the States. I'd won a tournament 2 or 3 weeks before up at Oakmont, a non-tour event, but a nice event with all the top players playing. And then losing in the playoff the week before. So a lot of guys knew I was in good form, even though the bookies hadn't recognized it. So felt comfortable, went out for practice round. When I arrived there Monday afternoon, I had a practice round again Tuesday, again Wednesday, playing well. And I just tried to get myself into the frame of mind that let's treat this like any other tournament back in the States or any other major event that we'd been playing, to not let it get too much for me, I guess. I knew I could win. I knew I was in good form. I really wanted to win, obviously. But I had never been in that situation, I guess, where I felt like I was one of the guys you had to beat if you were going to win that week. It was unusual for me. I wasn't a Norman or a Faldo or a Strange or one of the Pricey, one of the top guys. I was one of the guys that I knew I could do it if I played my best. I was about 20th in the world at the time. So having Jenny there with me in a nice, comfortable environment in a little house down the street just allowed me to go play golf.
So you didn't share a house with five other guys then, huh?
No.
No, I could have. By then, I could afford to rent our own house. It was, but even then, it was like £2,500 or something. It wasn't these days. Some of those homes are $20,000. It's quite expensive now to rent homes and travel with your family.
So, at the Open that year, Finchie, you got nice steady starts. The first two rounds, 71-71, but then, boy, you turned it on the last two rounds. 130 is pretty low around Birkdale for 2 days, man. That was great.
Yeah, Birkdale's a great test, isn't it? What a lovely golf course. How do you rate it, Bruce? Did you rate it as one of the better open venues?
I thought it was, yeah. Obviously, I love the old course. We even talked about my first relationship with the old course, but I did love Birkdale. And of course, I won a World Golf Championship there. And when I came back from winning, I named the new house that we built in Canberra Birkdale. Yeah, mm-hmm. That was the name of the house.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I think Birkdale's a great track. Very rewarding.
Yeah, I agree with
shots,
you. And it just sits there amongst the dunes. It's almost a... Obviously, it's well over 100 years old, but it's like a modern course in that it's a great gallery course because of the dunes and the way the course is set up.
I don't know what kind of weather you guys had that particular week. My first exposure to Birkdale, I played it in a 4-club wind, and it wasn't a lot of fun for an amateur.
No, but it's a fabulous test of golf, I think. And it's not, it's not one of those overly long golf courses, but... it's fun to play, especially when you're playing good and you can shoot 130 for two rounds. Goodness me.
It was the greens weren't good, and I think that was the big knock that week is the greens were in bad shape. And I think, it's 30 years ago now, but I think they redid the surfaces of the greens the following week. They knew they needed to do something. Something had happened to the greens with, a fertilizer or something that they had applied to the greens in preparation for the Open. So I think they redid them after. They were that poor. They were that kind of grainy. It's that natural fescue, the grass there, but it was not good. So putts were hard to make, and everyone was saying how difficult it was. But the greens got a little better as the week went on. And I had I finished eagle birdie the last two holes on the Saturday for 64. Had played well all day, but just started to hole a couple of putts there on the homecoming nine, and that got me into the last group again. So, and I think the best thing about being in the final group this time was I played alongside Mark O'Meara, and Mark was a good buddy of mine. We were practice mates back in Florida in Orlando where we lived, and he was a fast walker and a smooth swinger. And someone I really liked to play with because we had a good chat. We were buddies. We pulled for each other. That was my ideal partner, someone like that. That, if you have someone that you like watching their swing or they keep you in a good rhythm. And I was a 5 mile an hour walker, long legs, like a Davis Love. I loved playing with Davis as well. Same thing. You just chatted along the way. It was just a comfortable pairing.
Your caddy that week?
Pete Bender. Pete is one of the more famous caddies that came out on tour in the late 70s. He and Andy Martinez, I believe, were the two of the first. Andy used to caddy for Johnny Miller. And I believe they may have been two of the first handful of caddies that caddied at Augusta for the Masters. Used to have to have, Bruce, you'd know, you had to have a local caddy for many years there. So anyway, Pete was great. He'd also caddied for Greg Norman when Greg won in 86 at Turnberry.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me. One in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you had to be there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
So that must have been helpful to have him on the bag. He was not your regular caddy?
Yeah. Pete was my caddy for about 3 years, from 89 to 92. I wished I'd kept him. I didn't play very well after he left, unfortunately. We had a little argument one day on a golf course that he basically said, oh, well, I think we should have a rest. And I said, okay, well, if you think so. It was sort of the end of the season, and I was going back to Australia to play for 4 months, and he got another bag. And
that was it.
Anyway.
It's like any other relationship. That's life.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's hard being a caddy, but Pete was great, and I still keep in touch with him. He still caddies a bit out on the Champions Tour. He's in his 70s now, and one of the really good guys. Caddied a lot for Jack Nicklaus along the way, and amongst others, you know, Greg. And anyway, he kept me going. He said it was like riding secretariat that week. He said, just stay out of the way and make sure you stay on.
Well, as I recall, Seve had the lead after round one. I think he shot four under, and then my notes say he caught a bad draw. I don't know. Was there some weather issues on day two that might have caught some guys on half a day?
Yeah. It was poor weather, and it was the largest cut ever in the history of the Open. I want to say it was 118 players. Yeah. 108 or 118 players made the cut because it was a 10-shot rule and two under par lead.
Okay. Yeah, so that's the reason why then. Two under par lead, huh?
I think Elk was tied for fourth after the second round, so he was in it for a while.
He was. It was a really good field all the way through as far as the leading players at that time were there. And I remember Seve making some comment after the third round that he didn't think the guys at the top would be able to win, that he thought he was a good chance because, you know, guys like Marco Mira and myself, we didn't have the experience. Like, there's kind of a silly comment for Seve to make. It kind of makes you try a bit harder.
So you shoot 29 on the front on your last round. Is that right?
Yeah, I was just in a zone, hitting the ball exactly where I wanted to hit it, just at the flag most of the time, or where I wanted to hit it if it was a tight shot. Drove it in every fairway. And that allowed me, I hold it from about 10 foot at two, 10 foot at three, maybe 12 foot at four, 6 or 8 feet at six, and about 15 feet at seven. So I was five under par through seven holes. And I remember looking up at the leaderboard. And I was walking off the back of the seventh green, and I saw my name up there above Seve, and Freddie Couples was there, and Mike Harwood. I think Eamon Darcy was up there. Greg, Jody Mudd was playing well that last day. It was a good board, but I was five in front. And I thought, bloody hell, I better not screw this one up or I won't be allowed back in to go home. So.
Now, had you had that thought, let's say 6-8 years before that, might it have been a different result?
Yeah, I think previously I was a bit of a pretender. I was capable of shooting good scores, but I wasn't really a winner. And by this time, I had won enough or believed in myself enough that I knew if I did play my best, I could win. I was one of those guys that could just sneak up and win. I wasn't one of the top 10, although I got into the top 10 in the world when I won. Anyway, I knew I could do it if I just focused and didn't let the moment, you know, get the better of me, and I kept playing well. I just hit every green and two-putted all the way home. So, yeah, if you've got the lead and you're in the last group and you shoot 29, the front nine, you're usually in pretty good shape.
Pretty good shape is right.
Was there a moment at all before that final putt dropped where you felt comfortable?
I had a couple of birdie chances, like the par 5 15th, and I missed the putt, but I was still well in front, still like at least a couple in front. Mike Harwood was playing well. Marco Mura was right there, Freddie Couples. And at 16, I hit a good drive. It was a hard hole in the wind, and I hit a good 4-iron that nearly hit the flag and went about 15 foot by. And I remember saying to my caddy, "You like that one, Petey? You like that one, mate?" And he said, "Oh, I love it, Vinci. I love it." And I missed the putt, but I two-putted to go to 17, which was a reachable par 5 with a two-shot lead. And I just knew that if I could hit it in the fairway at 17, I could reach the green. So I hit a good drive, and I knocked a 5-iron on the green and two-putted for birdie. So I went to the last tee with a 3-shot lead.
Okay. Yeah.
So then it was not a foregone conclusion. You know, you can still lose it, but you'd have to be bloody stupid.
Yeah.
So I just aimed it down the left rough. I didn't take that bunker on, Bruce. You know, the big bunker out there.
Stay away from that.
They probably fly it over it nowadays. Oh, but I just said, no, just go down the left rough. You can hit it out of the rough. If it's a bad lie, even you can lay up short of those bunkers and still make par or bogey.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I hit a left rough, 6-iron, just short right of the green, pitched it up to 15 feet, I guess, past the hole, nearly hold the chip, actually, and then two-putted for the win to win by two. So it was smart that I played safe. I didn't go for glory.
Yeah, it's not every major winner that gets to sort of relax and enjoy that walk down 18. So with a 3-shot lead, that's a heck of a lot different than being tied or one up or whatever.
Sure is.
That had to really be enjoyable.
Yeah. I would imagine the guys that have that opportunity many times, you know, going up the last but still needing to grind it out, par to win, or, you know, trying to birdie to beat the guy you're playing with or whatever that situation might be, that it's that's a grind. But going up there with 3 shots, I still had to keep my wits about me. I wasn't, waving to the crowd too much and celebrating. I still knew I needed to get the job done, but it was a great feeling. And then my buddy Wayne Grady, after I holed the putt, came running out with a bottle champagne. Of champagne, and we cheered each other with a champagne. And Jenny was there with Haley and Pete, of course. So it was really great feeling. It wasn't a massive celebration. I think I threw the ball into the crowd enjoyed it, but it was just good to have friends there at the end to share it with.
Yeah, there were 3 other Aussies in the top 10. Mike Harwood, of course, who finished second by 2. Craig Perry and Greg Norman all finished in the top 10 as well, yeah?
Uh-huh. And I think Pete Senior, another really, you may not know as much of him in the States, but Pete was a great player. Actually played 10 years on the Champions Tour here as well with great success. So he was right around as well. Yeah. We had a lot of good Aussies at that time, Bruce. I think at one point we had 10 in the top 60 in the world.
Yeah, well,
in that 90-91 period.
Well, 4 out of the top 10 at the Open Championship at Birkdale is pretty fancy too when you think about it.
Yeah, that's a heck
of an effort.
So let me quickly ask you about an anecdote I'd read about. You can tell me if it's true or not. Read somewhere where after shooting 79 on Friday to miss the cut, Mark Calcavecchia gave his clubs to a bunker attendant who in turn offered Calc his rake.
Very true.
That is true, huh? Oh, that's funny.
Yep.
They just decided to exchange implements, huh?
Oh, boy.
That was a nice thing for Calc to do. He was a funny bugger.
He was,
Calc.
Funny.
Yeah.
Bruce, I think we're going to try to have him on, so we'll have to ask him about that one.
Yeah, we will. We'll get him on at some time, I'm sure.
Have you been back for any special visits to Birkdale?
Yes. I've got a quick story for you that in 98, I decided I had played so poorly at Troon in 97, I should never have played. And anyway, that was my last Open. A lot of baggage, a lot of scar tissue after the 97 at Troon that Justin Leonard won. So in 98, I decided to do television for ABC in the States at Birkdale. And it was a really tough decision because when I was there, you know, people, you could hear people saying, he won here last time, he's not even playing. And it was just a dreadful time for me. But anyway, Mark won. I was really happy for him. And I got to congratulate him late in the evening on that Sunday night, and that was a special moment. But leading into that, Japan TV asked me to come and do a walkthrough with them as they were the broadcaster for Japan. I think it was NHK. And I walked with their host, their Jim Nance, if you will, for the 18 holes. And we walked and I showed him where I'd hit it on the last round. And we talked about it. And then he said on the 18th tee, I'm going to leave you to walk the last hole by yourself. This is the first time you've been back in 7 years. And I'm just going to leave you to, you know, enjoy the moment. And it kind of gets me a little bit choked up just thinking about it now. The club had recorded the 18th hole of 91 when I came up the last, or they had the recording from television or whatever, however they had achieved that. And because this was a couple of weeks before the Open, all of the stands and everything had been set up, and they played the crowd noise and the excitement of 91 through the speakers as I walked up in 98. And everyone came out of the clubhouse and clapped around on the stand there over the back of the 18th green. So that was a really special moment for me.
What a nice thing for them to do. Yeah.
Yeah, very, very special.
Your championship medal is on display at the clubhouse at Birkdale?
Mm-hmm. I donated my medal back with all of the my memorabilia from that last round back to Royal Birkdale. So they have it all there for people to view. Actually, I had a mate of mine this morning said, there's so many bloody photos of you here at Royal Birkdale, Finchie. And he sent me a lot of pics. He was up there, an English fella, friend of mine was up there playing. So, yeah, I like that about Birkdale. I've got a beautiful display of all of the old champions, Arnold Palmer, Peter Thompson, Padraig Harrington recently, obviously Mark O'Meara, Johnny Miller. So all of the past champions there have got a big display. But my medal had been sitting in the drawer for like 28 years or something, and I asked my daughters, I said, hey, look, I've got this medal. It's been sitting in the drawer. It's worth a lot of money to someone if you wanted to sell it, but I'd like, if you don't want it, I'm just going to donate it back to Royal Birkdale, and we donated a bunch of money to charity with that gesture. But it was just so nice for them to have it and display it rather than sitting in my drawer for forevermore.
Nice of the girls to let it go too.
Yes.
I'll give a quick shout out to Chris Hilton, the friend who was a former captain of the RNA, who tipped me off to your generosity there, and that's why I asked about it. He might have been part of some of that ceremony.
Hmm. Yep, he was. I gave it to him actually at the Australian Open a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago now, when he was captain, and I hadn't got a chance to go back to Birkdale to do it, so we did it. He was actually at the Australian Open, and we did it there. So anyway, yes, he was a big part of that.
That's great. Well, you know, finishing off your list of former winners, Seve was a former winner, Tom Watson, a former winner there, Jordan Spieth.
Mm-hmm, Jordan, that's right.
And so, you know, you go through that list. I'm not sure, is there a better list of champions at an open venue?
Pretty hard to find a better list, man. I can tell you that.
Yeah, it's a great venue. Great to be there with Tomo and Arnold.
It's a pretty good list. Okay, anything else that you'd like to reflect on from that 1991 victory at Royal Birkdale?
No, just to say that obviously was the best moment in my golfing career, of course, to win my goal, to win the Open Championship. So I'm forever known as an Open champion because of that 1 week and that great week at Royal Birkdale. So forever grateful and humbled by it.
Well, you had a chance in your career also to represent your country, and I know you had a chance to play in the President's Cup, or rather to serve as vice captain and as Gary Player's assistant captain across combined, I guess, four different President's Cups. You represented Australia in the 1985 World Cup and the Dunhill Cup in 89 and 92. So quite a bit of team competition as well.
Yeah, always good fun. It's hard in golf. We all love team sport, Bruce, don't we? Coming from Australia, we played everything.
Yeah, there's not much in golf, though, unfortunately.
And when it's available, you do it. The World Cup was always tough because it was often opposite the Australian Open, so I had many more chances to play it. But it was hard to miss your national championship to travel around the world, and the money wasn't like it is now. So the President's Cup was a lot of fun. Being there with the guys, not being able to play well enough anymore to make the team to be the vice captain with Gary Player and co-captain once with Peter Thompson. Lots of great memories there with the guys to represent, do the best you could. Always ended in tears there for me because we didn't win. We tied one time with Gary in 03, but you do everything you possibly can to make the team the best you can, give them the best opportunity. And at the end of the day, you come up a little bit short. It's always hard to take when you can't control it yourself.
Something we didn't touch on last time, we'll get your comments on it. It's at some point in your career, I think it was probably 95 or so, you found that you weren't playing the way you wanted to play. Take us a little bit through for our listeners what went on with your game.
Basically, I could spend an hour on the couch with a psych unpacking all of that, but let's not do that. I just lost my confidence. I really wanted to win more majors, to be a better player. And I figured the number one thing I needed to do was to hit the ball farther. I was an average hitter. I was well up in the stats in every other category, top 10 in every stat except driving distance. I was average. I was 260, 265 at that time. So I was between 90th and 100th on tour. And I tried to flatten the arc of my swing to hit the ball further, and I lost the ability to hit it down the left with a fade. And every once in a while, I'd hit one down the left thinking I'd bring it back and I'd pull it a yard or two, and that became a fear, and it became a hook at the wrong time. And basically, I just lost my confidence. So come 95, I played half a dozen tournaments at the start of the year, and I'd missed the cut in all of them. And I took about a 2-month break. Went to the gym every day, did a yoga class every day, got myself in great shape, went and saw a sports psych, did everything I possibly could to try and get myself more confident in myself to go play again. And I still came back and would miss every cut by a shot. Mm. So that year I played 15 events, missed all 15 cuts. 96 I started out, and I played 11. The British Open in 96 was my 11th tournament in a row, and I missed all of the cuts. So I'd missed 26 in a row, I guess.
Boy.
Amongst others that I played. So it was bloody hard. I could still play. I could still shoot 66 on Wednesday in the Pro-Am, but I'd hit it out of bounds off the first tee on Thursday, that type of thing. And I stepped away from the game, said to my wife, Jenny, I'm going to take a year off, just going to go practice. Gary Edwin was a nice enough mentor and friend back home to try and reteach me the game. Unfortunately, it was different to how I had taught myself, so I never really gravitated to what he was trying to teach me, although it was very good. He had taught many other really good players.
Yeah. It's hard to change,
I just couldn't
though.
Do it. It is, mate. Yeah, I wished now that I had just gone and figured out what my swing was again and just done that. But the confidence is very hard to – confidence can be shed very, very quickly, and it's very, very hard to rebuild.
Mind, yeah, the mind, know, man. Whew.
For our listeners who are, you know, listening, saying, wait a minute, Ian Baker Finch – champion golf of the year 1991, one of the best in the world, and you know, how do you lose confidence? But for anybody that's played the game,
I understand.
You're right. What happens between the years impacts a lot of how you perform on the golf course, doesn't it?
It's very, very difficult.
You know, the great Yogi Bearism, you know, he said it's 90% mental and the other 10% is all in your head.
Yeah, right, the other 10 in your head.
And that's so true.
Maybe that's why this game is so hard. And you know, you might have shared this with us the first time we were together. I know other guests have shared this, but they've all agree, I think, that if there's anything that's really advanced other than technology in the last 30 years in the game, it's the mental side and how these young kids are coached differently, prepared differently for that part of the game.
Yes, totally. The science of the game, the information sharing is just incredible these days. So there's the kids come out of high school ready for college, already on a path.
Absolutely.
And they have...
That's the biggest change I've seen.
Yes. Their team. They have a team with them that trains them, coaches them, leads them, feeds them. It's amazing what's available to them now. But then you still have to work hard. It's not any easier. And the depth of talent is so far greater that the rewards are there. Athletes take up the game now at a young age because of, you know, the way Tiger, I think, was the impetus in that. Athletes, not that the guys before weren't athletes, but more and more are coming along now. And the equipment, Bruce, we could go on and do a whole show on the equipment. I'm sure a lot of your other guests on this show know a lot more about it than me and have been interesting conversations, I'm sure, about the equipment.
However, it's worth finding out what your thoughts are about the equipment too, Finchie. You know, the game today is totally different to the one that you played when you were a very, very good player.
Yes. The speed they create is immensely different to the way we played. We had the ball that spun so much we had to keep it in play. You can't tell me that Tom Weisskopf and Greg Norman and Jack Nicklaus couldn't have swung at 124 mile an hour as well if that had a 45-inch long graphite shafted driver that weighed 3 ounces less than the ones they used.
Correct.
You know, that they were athletes. Arnold Palmer, Gary Player, yourself, you know, Crampton, all of the guys, Watson. So, but the equipment wasn't such that you could swing that fast and control the ball. So, yes, equipment has allowed a lot of the changes in the way the game's played. And then, you know, you get into the way golf courses are set up now, Bruce. The distance. Now, if you're not a long hitter, you're behind the eight ball. You can be a Kevin Na. You can be an average length hitter and win occasionally and grind it out, and he's the best putter and the best short game guy on the game. And he can win occasionally. But if you want to be a real champion and win all the time, you've got to be able to hit the ball over 300 yards. And, you know, I don't think we're going to see too many more Corey Pavins in the game of golf or Jeff Sluman's. You know, you're going to have a lot more Brooks Koepkas and Dustin Johnsons and Bryson DeChambeaus coming through because distance is the key.
Yeah.
So I guess an obvious question then, Ian, would be, do you think changes need to be made for the good of the game?
You can answer that easily on either side of that question. You can say, no, the game's so exciting. We're bringing younger people to the game. The guys are so athletic. Let's leave it the way it is. And you can also say, well, if we're going to save all our great historic golf courses, and if the disparity between the tour player and the average player is so wide now, it's 100 yards per hole difference between a good amateur player and the tour player. The way the courses are played is so different with this new equipment. So if we want to save all those icons of the game, maybe we need to change the ball or the driver head size or something. But there's a lot of smarter people than me trying to figure out this problem. And do we change anything for 1% of the players in the world of golf? Do we just let them do what they do and make all of the old great courses par 70s and add back tees and keep the game exciting for the young fan with the Bryson DeChambeaus hitting at 375? you know, you can't design a course for the elite players now. It's impossible.
And there's certain things that the ruling bodies are not going to be able to control. They're not going to be able to control these guys getting faster and stronger. That's just going to happen. There's not a thing they can do about it. So the only tools at their disposal really are the implements you use to play the game.
It's a tough one, though, isn't it? Do you want to stop the athleticism, and do you want to curtail those abilities? My fear is that it will become too one-dimensional, where everyone will be Wilco Nienaber, 365 in the air, Bryson DeChambeau. Dustin Johnson will become average at 330, you know, eventually, if it keeps going this way. Is that good for the game? It's exciting to watch. So in some ways it is. But when someone like me, who can still play the game quite well, I'd still compete from 165 yards in, say.
Yeah.
But they're 100 yards past me off the tee. So I have to go play the blues and look back at the blacks way back there. I can't even play the tips anymore.
Yeah.
As a plus three handicap at the club, I can still play the game, but I can't play it from 7,700 yards.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think that's one of the big problems that the game faces over the next 20 years is how do we save the great courses that have no more room to...
Well, you can't.
Can't, can you?
You really can't. You know, look at a club like Merion. I mean, where... You know Marion like I do. I mean, how do you put another 400 and 500 yards at Marion? You can't do it.
No, they did well to add 300 or 400 more to the way it used to be when we played for the last Open.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's still short.
Yeah.
You know, on today's average, that these guys are playing, it's a. I don't know. Like you said, Finchie, though, you're right. You know, you can argue both sides of that issue. It's an easy argument from both sides, but I know where I sit on it. I think the guys that control the game, the RNA and the USJ, they got to do something about it.
Ian, what do you think will happen? You're fairly close to the game yet. You meet a lot of people that are in the know and are involved. What do you think the USG and the RNA will end up doing, if anything?
Well, I think they're going to have to stop this concertina effect with all the clubs, like particularly now. You know, we talk about driving and that a lot, but I hear Ian doing television for CBS, and somebody's 247 yards from the middle of the green, and he's hitting a damn 4-iron. Well, you know, 4-irons. In our day, because I'm a lot older than you, Finchie, but, you know, 4-iron for me was, you know, full out 185.
Mm.
So, you know, you're talking about a hell of a difference.
Yeah, well, 4-iron, when I first started, when you were playing pro golf, it was 26 degrees. And it was 39 inches long. And now it's 40 inches long, like our old 2-irons. And probably 22 degrees, some maybe even stronger. A lot of guys, 4-iron's their longest iron in the bag now. Some of the 4-irons are like driving irons. They hit it so far.
And none of those iron clubs are solid blocks of metal anymore.
No.
They're all hollow in the middle, and that face, you know, it's like a concertina face. And that 4-iron with 3 degrees less loft still goes high or higher than the old 4-iron.
It's totally different, and with a lightweight shaft, and with more speed in the modern day swing, it's all about the speed and then the athleticism. Do the governing bodies have? I think they're trying to do whatever they can without causing too much trouble, but have they really? They haven't fixed the putting problem, but the putting problem isn't really causing the scores to be any different in the game. The things that they've touched really are fringe issues, like making the longest the driver can only be 46 inches maximum now. Right. You know, what if you get a guy that's 6'8"? You know, he might need a 47-inch driver. You know, it's just fair. True. And with putting, they should just say, hey, the putter has to be the shortest club in the bag. Just go ahead and do it. Just say, hey, that's the rule. Has to be the shortest club in the bag. Lob wedges can only be 60 degrees. Drivers can only be 46 inches. Driver head should be 300cc instead of 460cc. Just go in and make the rule. But then they're worried about the legal side of things too. And
they got to fight all the manufacturers. The manufacturers today, you know, they got new equipment out every 3 to 6 months. It's fascinating, really.
And it's amazing. Anyway, I think something needs to be done. They're all trying to get together to do the best they can for the game. But at the same time, we've got to continue to try and grow the game and have young people play. And they kind of like it the way it is. So,
thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.